Hello, UX folks, and welcome for this episode of UXchange. In this episode, we will talk about the difficulties of recruiting participants for confidential UX research studies. As a side note, this episode has been taken from a Medium article that I wrote myself on the topic. And the Medium article itself has been written following a mentorship session that I had in which we discussed about the difficulty of recruiting participants for confidential UX research studies. As a disclaimer, I'm not a professional of UX research operations, and I know that participant recruitment is a topic in itself which requires rigor. However, I had to deal myself with participant recruitment in the past. So this article has been written for those who, like me, already struggled or are struggling with participants recruitment in UX research. So if you are a seasoned UX research ops specialist or an expert in participants recruitment, some of the solutions I propose might surprise you. I want to acknowledge that the purpose of this article is to provide to UX professionals solutions to deal with this complexity, and some of the solutions are not without limits. The limits should be considered and better solutions always exist. However, sometimes dealing with uncertainty and bias is necessary. Where can we find participants for UX research studies that can be confidential? So I see you coming. Now we have the amazing support of UX research ops. Well, you will not always work in companies in which you have UX research ops. So you might have to deal with the recruitment yourself. Or you might also have to conduct a passion project in UX research to be able to showcase a case study, a portfolio, in order to get your first job as a UX researcher. But then, how do you do it? Don't worry, I got you covered. To begin with, let's talk about quickly my first experience as a UX researcher, or back then the equivalent, and at the same time, my first experience with recruiting participants. So I entered my first job as a cognitive scientist at a big car manufacturer in Paris. And I was in charge of measuring driver stress, since it's a major cause for accidents. And I came from a neuroscience background, so I was in charge of leading physiological research with electrocardiograms, electroencephalograms, respiratory data, and the like. It was super cool. But I got to a part which was less cool, which is participants recruitment. So back then, UX research operations was not a common practice inside companies. And on a side note, I know UX research operations are not here only to recruit participants, but it's also a big part of their day-to-day activities. That's why I mention them so often, and I'm really grateful that this discipline now exists. So the problem is, I was working on technologies that would be launched, if they were to be launched, not before 5, 8, or 10 years. So they were highly confidential. As such, everything was under non-disclosure agreement, and you could imagine how difficult it could be to have real customers. So the first option that I would give my listeners who want to run research with confidential prototypes, and please hear UX research ops or specialists, don't freak out. I would advise you to try at least to take participants from your company, to recruit participants from your company. Or it is the somehow I managed technique, as I like to call it. If you know the show called The Office, you know what I'm talking about. So for instance, I was working for this big corporation with a lot of processes and ADA, and the solution I came up with to conduct user research was to recruit participants from my company. Which is super weird, because of course, these are not the people you first think about when you want to investigate users or customers. For instance, If I sell cars, I would maybe first check the customer database to recruit them at a source. But in the end, when you think about this, it's not that weird, because even employees of your own company can be customers, and often are. In my case, my coworkers in my company, which was selling cars worldwide, all also bought cars. But I want to come here with a little side note and a little alert. Your study in this case will be biased. So this is the negative aspect. The positive one, if we can call it positive, is that all your studies will be biased. All UXR studies are inherently biased at some point. Don't freak out, I will expand on this further. But in this case, let's consider some of the biases. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact name, and maybe there are some fancy and scientific names for them. But in this podcast, I will call them brand image bias and loyalty bias. So, you might know by now that all UX research studies are biased to some extent. Your role as a UX researcher includes to be able to identify, acknowledge the bias, and try to reduce it. Let's say you work at a company. If you interview people from this company and ask them how they feel regarding your amazing prototype, you highly run the risk of gathering biased answers, and for multiple reasons. For instance, the participants might fear that their answers will be disclosed inside the company, even if you make your participants sign agreements, or statements, or privacy notice, which forbids you, by the way, to disclose personal information and information associated to their names inside the company or wherever else, such as John Doe is registered at this bank, or whatever, or goes to buy his bread on Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. in that bakery. You cannot disclose that these informations. Participants might fear that you will do it, even though you make them sign agreements. I lived this in the past, and it happens, especially in the professional context. Also, you have to consider that participants working for the company might feel loyalty towards the company itself and its products. They might also fear hurting your feelings, because in the end, you may not be close coworkers. And by the way, I do not advise you to run research on close coworkers if you want to decrease the bias. It depends on your research, but overall, I would advise against it. Maybe for some feedback, design critique, but not for user sessions. Still, they are your coworkers. But they're not your close coworkers, they're not your friends, they're not your family. But still, as you're working in the same company, there is this kind of feeling of belonging and feeling of sharing the same workspace and the same experience, which might make them fear hurting your feelings by saying something negative about the prototype. By negative, I'm not saying that they will say, your prototype is crappy. No. I'm thinking about saying things like, I do not intend to use your prototype because it doesn't answer my needs, or this feature is not accessible. They might still fear to give this kind of feedback. And this is a huge bias, of course. But don't worry, not all participants inside the company will fear giving hurtful feedback. I had it in the past, some participants in my company saying things like, no, your prototype is not good at all, I don't like it, and I do not see how it can be useful for me, or for all the users in general. Now, how to reduce this bias? So, in this case, first of all, as I was saying, your job as a UX researcher is to acknowledge the bias. Mention to your stakeholders in your reports and in your further discussions, always, that if you had access, of course, to customers outside of the company, it would be perfect. But as we know, we are not in a perfect situation. So in this case, maybe as a solution, as a temporary fix, try to make your prototype as anonymous as possible so that the participant could not think that the prototype is made by this company you're both working in, or could even believe that this prototype has been made by a competitor. If it's not possible, I would advise you to try to focus your study on behaviors. And there is still a lot to do about that, like usability, ergonomics, human factors, to name a few. Because of course, if you work both in the same company and you ask your participant what they think about the perception, how it relates to the brand, their intention to use, it's a bit tricky when you deal with this kind of biases. Then there is another kind of bias, which I will call the expert bias or the expertise bias. And this is related to the experience that your participant has inside the company. Because your participant might know a bit about some or all of the features of your product, your prototype, or some related features. And if they know something, trust me, they already know too much. They might, for instance, project themselves too much and giving biased feedback related to, for instance, the fact that XYZ feature is not much realistic or that it requires too much effort to implement. So this is surely not the kind of feedback that you want, as it may not be related to the research question at all. But now you may think, how can I reduce this bias? In this case, for the expertise bias, I would advise against interviewing participants who know too much. So what I did in the past, which proved to be useful, first of all, is double checking with my manager, asking them, do you think that this direction overall could be biased if I interview them? You could also mention the criteria for recruitment inside a participant's mailing list. So for instance, you would say in the mail, the invitation email that you send to all your participants, you would say, do not want people who already participated in studies in the past of this kind in the past 6 months, or who work on XYZ part of the car. To be sure, to make sure that your participants in your study that you have recruited match this criteria, you can double this email with a screener. A screener is a questionnaire that you will give your participants and which would help you to filter out the participants that you do not want in your study. Now, a second option. As I was saying, this strategy is the one I used for my first job as a cognitive scientist. It was 7 years ago. Then I moved to another company, also a global automotive maker. And there I entered the magic of recruitment agencies. Believe it or not, I didn't know that existed. So I struggled with participants' recruitment, and then I talked about this to a colleague, and I remember she told me, but what do you think this would be that complicated? We have recruitment agencies. Basically, we pay agencies to recruit participants for us. And this was marvelous to me. So, you have to know that different types of collaborations exist in this case. Some agencies will only recruit participants. And in this case, you also have several types of cases. So either you provide them with the goals of your study and they will advise you regarding the main criteria you have to have in mind to recruit your participants. But they can also ask you to send your participant criteria. You can also have some agencies that will handle everything from user recruitment to research report through the field study. And here you may be asked by the agency to handle the survey or qualitative interview script to give them all this material. In this case, please oversee the research study to make sure everything is being conducted according to the plan. But the takeaway here is that you have several collaboration modes between you and the agency. The last option I would consider is what I would call the do-it-yourself recruitment, DIY recruitment. So if we are under the assumption that you do not have the chance to have UX research operations departments, if you do not want to have the bias that we mentioned for the first solution, or if you cannot pay external agencies, another way would be to have the recruitment carried out by yourself. So several solutions exist in this case. You could first of all leverage your internal customer database. Imagine I work at a big car manufacturer. Maybe we can think about the marketing department that already carry out research studies. You may also ask for access to the customer database of this company. So this might be tricky for legal reasons, because we know now that we have regulations such as GDPR. So these regulations allow companies to contact customers to run research studies only and only if they gave their informed consent. This would be stated in a privacy statement as an agreement to a statement such as, I hereby accept to be contacted by XYZ company to participate in research studies and share my data. So now that it's being enforced, it's more difficult to recruit participants, but it doesn't mean that it would be impossible for you to have access to the customer database. Simply check with the marketing or business department to see if they could allow you to access the customer database for you to contact some customers to run your study. You can also think about using testing platforms. So for instance, if you have a prototype which is only digital and you want to test it in a kind of usability study, you could make use of usability testing platforms such as Maze, UserZoom, Userlytics, and you have a lot of ways to do it. You can do usability study, you can do concept testing, you can add some questions as a follow-up, and so on. So through these platforms, you can nowadays launch the test to a pool of participants that the platform will recruit. Of course, you will be paying either by participants, but you also can submit to the platform your file of user data. In this case, the platform, the recruitment will be handled by the platform with your file and with your participants. And in this case, of course, you're not paying. You can also think about sharing your study on the internet. So think about, for instance, in this case, communities such as Facebook, WhatsApp, Telegram communities, Reddit forums, and the like. But now you would tell me, of course, in this case, it doesn't solve the main issue that we had at the beginning of this podcast, which is my participants will still have access to confidential information. What can I do? You, of course, want to avoid this conversation that John Doe would have at the barbecue on a Sunday midday to his friend, saying, you would never believe me regarding this new feature that XYZ company is launching. I'm so smart. You want to avoid that, of course. So about that, you can begin with this idea that I shared before of anonymity. So as I said earlier, making products, prototypes you want to test anonymous serves multiple purposes. First of all, it can reduce bias from your participants. As I was saying, if they do not know from which company the prototype is, they cannot have their answers biased because they are loyal or they fear hurting you. But it also decreases the likelihood of them sharing information about this company and about the prototype that this company is about to launch. Then, of course, think about NDA. NDA is an acronym for non-disclosure agreement. So as customers themselves and all of us, we are all customers and users. As we are all protected by regulations regarding our data and data protection regulations, you can as well as a worker of XYZ company protect your prototype, your knowledge, and your company against data theft, for instance, or data disclosure or confidential information disclosure. And to do that, you would have to handle to your participants what we call a non-disclosure agreement. So this is a contract that forbids them to divulge anything about the study to anyone, even their baby. So however, let's say that you share your study and your prototype on the internet and you have your participants signing an NDA. Well, it doesn't assure you that they will not share screenshots of your prototype. And here I want to emphasize on a side note that this is why sharing studies in general, prototype and knowledge to the outside world is also and always based on a trade-off. It's a trust trade-off. It's a balance between the risk and your need to trust. If having participants filling out your survey or your usability study is super risky in terms of confidentiality, but you really need those results for next week, well, you might consider sharing this study. It all depends on your policy, agreements, and the rules. But there are still ways to reduce risks. Imagine you have to share your prototype on the internet and you fear confidentiality issues. Well, I have personally never tried it, but in my career, I already talked to designers who provided me tips regarding this matter. And this included, for instance, making a prototype link dynamic so that every participant would have a different link. You could also think about having a link that is active and that is working only at certain hours during the day or only until the participant fills the study. So then even if John Doe, super smart John Doe, wants to forward the link, the prototype link to his friend, it will not work, for instance. And finally, of course, I didn't mention it until now. It's because I think it's the best way to ensure confidentiality. In my opinion, inviting participants to your facilities is the good old way, but the best working way to ensure that you're avoiding issues regarding confidentiality. Of course, it depends on the means you have at your disposal and your research methodology. So for instance, imagine you have to conduct 10 interviews or 10 moderated usability tests in 1 week. And if you have a confidential prototype to show, whether it's physical or digital, you could invite your participants directly to your facilities to better manage the confidentiality. Of course, if you have a computer on which your prototype is, you make your participants entering the room and conducting the study, and then when they go out, they cannot take anything from your prototype with them because you would be monitoring them. And of course, this is what we often refer to as usability lab. And maybe you read the book by Erica Hall called Just Enough Research. And at some point in her book, amazing book by the way, she speaks about usability labs, and she says very cleverly, and I completely agree with her, there is no such thing as a usability lab. You want your participants to test your prototype in the nature, in their natural environments. We want to hear babies crying, we want to hear doorbells, and so on. So, and I completely agree, because in the end, you want to test your prototype in a natural environment. And that leads me to the last point, which I think for me would be the best, really best way to conduct your research if it's confidential. And this works if your prototype is physical and if your prototype is digital. Again, for those who, like me, worked in big car manufacturer companies, when I say physical, it all depends on the size of your prototype and if you can take it out of your company, of course. But the same way we can invite participants to your facilities, you can also conduct what we call contextual inquiries and ethnographic research. You could go to your participants' homes and test your prototype there. And then you will have the best of both worlds. You will have the best of confidentiality because you will be there monitoring your participants. They can't take screenshots. Imagine you test an app. Well, the app is on your phone. nothing can go out of your app. But then you can also take this as an advantage to gather richer data. And I think this might be the occasion for me to have a further podcast on this topic. As the bottom line, running UX research studies on confidential material is touchy, tricky, and comes with compromises. So the first one will always be this balance, as I was saying, between the risk and the need to trust. So in this case, you still have ways to reduce the risk of the participants to share information. In this case, think about non-disclosure agreements, inviting the participants to your facilities, prototypes, dynamic links, anonymizing your research, and of course, ethnographic research. All things considered, you still have several ways to find participants at your disposal. You can run the research with people from your company. You can leverage online platforms, social media, recruitment agencies, and finally, trying to get your hand on the holy grail, which is customers' contact data. And that's it for the episode of today. Thank you for listening until the end.